Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Welcome to the second installment of Freak Flag Flying with David Crosby. In this episode, we'll talk about the folk music that inspired David to speak out publicly about issues that are important to him, which continues today with his fiery tweets about this dire moment in American history. We'll also talk about David's early years in the Byrds, songwriting as life advice, the struggles with addiction to hard drugs that robbed David of his songwriting abilities in the 1980s, and the very sweet life that he and his wife Jan have built together since then.
How could Samson? I thought he was blind as a bat. How could he tear down the temple like that? Couldn't know whereof he spoke. When all of his wheeling and dealing, turning him into a joke.
The whole thing is, you were part of a generation where idiosyncratic, very individual voices were what they were looking for. They were you, James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, Jackson Browne. Like, you guys were all excellent song crafters. Mm-hmm. Like, you knew how to write good songs. You came from a tradition. Like, one thing you didn't mention as an influence on your early career was your family would also have, like, evenings where they would get together and sing folk songs out of the fireside book of folk music.
Folk songs, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And I grew up listening to the Weavers, too, actually. My parents were commies. I'm a red diaper baby. Mm-hmm. And so we would listen to Talking Union, you know, and like Pete Seeger and all that shit and the Weavers. It was great. I do want to give a plug to a friend, Jesse Jarnow's book about the Weavers called Wasn't That a Time? It's an excellent history of the Weavers and America at that time. I would definitely check it out. And that was the Weavers was a huge influence on you. Is that correct?
Very, very big.
Yeah.
They are where I started learning about having a set of values that you stuck up for. Now, I think Pete was wrong about picking communism because it doesn't work. It never has. There's never been a functioning communism on the planet, only dictatorships and oligarchies that called themselves communist states. But he was sticking up for what he believed in. That's the important part for me. He had something he believed in. He wasn't willing to shut up and sit down. Society tried to smack him down real hard, and he wouldn't go. He didn't shut up. He didn't sit down. Made me love him. Made me love him dearly. You know, he was totally right about all the other stuff, about racism and all that. You know, he stuck up for the right stuff. He's a good man. But I think the thing that made me fall in love with him was that he was willing to stick up for what he believed in.
Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrims' bride. So you've definitely tried to carry forward that tradition of being activist musician who would piss off the authorities any chance
natural,
you got.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That came natural to you.
Yeah. Well, I was always a punk. Always kind of, you know, I always was rooting for the underdog.
You and were an underdog. Is that not true?
Yeah.
Like in high school, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I always had that attitude. And you got to remember, the first encounters I had with being anti-establishment were that the establishment was, in the 50s, still fully racist. That was how it was. Hey, remember the phrase, that's mighty white of you?
Oh, I know. It's horrible.
What a phrase.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, that's where I came from.
Yeah.
Okay? So that was so egregiously wrong. And that thing happened that I described in the documentary with my mom and the Josh White singing Strange Fruit.
It's an amazing song. Billie Holiday's version of that is so heavy.
Killer. It's fucking killer good.
Yeah.
And that really got me because my mom totally believed that. She was a fully humanist, fully we're all people. It doesn't fucking matter what color you are, which is what the truth is. I don't know why it's so fucking hard for people to understand it, but that is the truth. So that is a great way into having beliefs in the first place that are anti-establishment and that you feel strongly enough about to be willing to stand up for, put yourself at harm, at risk of harm for. You're willing to stand up in the street. Racism, yeah, that one, so clear. It was so clear. It wasn't like a maybe. I don't think politics involved. I could, to me, any six-year-old should have been able to figure that out. Well, you don't have to teach six-year-olds. They're not racist in the first place. They couldn't care less. That was a good way into it, a good way into having beliefs and that you stuck up for. I gained others, as life took me along. But the racism thing was so clear and so early and so unequivocal that it led me to being very staunchly willing to stand up for what I believed in and even put myself in risk.
People do so many things that make me mad, but angry isn't how I want to spend the time I have. Cognitive dissonance, they call it, and I wonder just how small it could be made to be in me. It's so much disturbing, short-sighted shit. They have to do better than live with it. I'm looking to find some peace to embrace, to bring that smile back to my face. Sometimes I'm winning. Life in the city is so densely packed. Fear of each other is an accepted fact. Fear soaks into concrete just like grease. Fear is the antithesis of peace. I have a dream, a great man said. Another man came and shot him in the head. Yet the dream floats out there visible, still alive, still. City
I'm very grateful to Greta Thunberg, the young autistic girl from Scandinavia, who has really raised global awareness of climate change among her own generation.
Oh, boy.
She has translated it to street. She has translated knowledge to street action and saying no, no, no to the BS from the Republican Party and the oil companies. And they know it's BS. They're all making business decisions behind the scenes, so they'll be hurt as little as possible as millions of climate refugees suddenly have to find new places to live as places go under the water.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable, but that generation is really waking up.
She is an absolute gift. I love her. You know, she's a 16-year-old kid. She's sitting there and she understands global warming. She understands climate change. She can follow the science. She says, well, my parliament isn't doing anything, so I'm going to go down there every Friday and leave school, go down there, and I will sit outside and tell them to do something. Her attitude, I'm sorry, I don't mean to upset you by saying that the house is on fire, but the fucking house is on fire!
Yeah, totally.
And she's not kidding.
And you can't swear with the, you can't blow smoke up her ass.
No, she's not kidding.
She doesn't want to hear it. She knows what the facts are. And, she knows that arguing against science is doom. You know,
she tells
it like it is.
I love her more than I can tell you. She's a real gift from God, that girl.
You and I have been talking, actually, that in part because you think about your son, Django, that you worry that his generation does not have a sense of much of a livable future. And they're making real day-to-day decisions about relationships, about having children, about commitment to their
career. I don't know if it's decisions.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's conscious.
Yeah.
As conscious as I've seen it get is, I'm not sure if we should bring a child into this world.
Right.
But they do anyway.
Yeah.
That question's been asked for a while.
Yeah.
I heard that question clear back in Vietnam times.
Right.
Now, there's something going on that I think if I was a person into, you know, trending and sociology and numbers, I'd really try to track this one. Young people are in, I think young people are in much higher numbers than anybody has even suspected so far, not planning a future. They're not planning a family. They're not planning a career. And I don't think that many of them have made a conscious decision about it. They're just not going that way. I don't think any of them really want to look at why. But I bet you the numbers will show that there's a sincere change, a sea change in young people's priorities, because a lot of them are not sure we'll make it. You got to remember that if you want to get the human race to grow, you have to bootstrap everybody. You have to get the most ignorant motherfucker we got and lift him too. And that's a very tough job.
Right.
And also, man, if we lose this next one, this is why this next election is going to be the biggest, bloodiest fight since the Civil War. Because if we lose this next one, then that puts us another 4 years before we even stand a chance of starting to deal with it. What we're dealing with right now is that if we don't gain control of Congress, we can't start dealing with global warming. We can't start dealing with the climate change, right? So that's where it's life and death. And this is going to be the biggest, nastiest fight you ever saw, because those guys don't play by the rules. And if a Koch brother tells you that he's put $80 million into this election, which he did say, that means he's put $250 million in. And that means there are eight other guys behind him who've also done the same. They're going to spend well over $1 billion trying to get him reelected. and they're going to try very hard. And if we don't succeed in beating them, we can't deal with climate change. And then I have to agree with my son. I don't think the human race will make it. It's that far.
Yeah.
We will only have 4-5 generations more, and that'll be drizzling out.
And under increasingly miserable and frightening conditions.
And losing millions of people a week.
Right. I mean, who could have expected that the new face of California would be wildfires so quickly with just, you know,
I got to tell you something. I think probably there's some Trumpers out there throwing cigarettes out their windows.
Yeah.
They don't. California has become a symbol to them,
right,
you know,
right.
of us hippies, you know,
right.
challenging their.
Well, he practiced on denying aid to Puerto Ricans after Hurricane Maria. And then he suddenly said he's going to cut the FEMA aid to California with the wildfires. He is sadistic.
Yeah.
There's something pathological about him.
He's only about 8 years old, man.
Yeah.
He's a kid who's never been allowed in his dad's office.
Yeah.
Who's broken in. And he's running around peeing in all the papers saying, I'll show them.
Right.
That's the little guy that he is.
Yeah.
And he's a shit.
Yeah.
And there's some other interesting things about him. Imagine this. He's never, ever made anybody come.
Yeah.
Ever. Not in his life.
Right, right.
He's only ever been serviced.
Right, right.
He has not ever made love to anyone.
Right.
He doesn't like dogs.
I know.
That's a dead giveaway.
Yeah.
He,
probably dogs don't like him.
They don't.
Right.
Here's a bigger one. He doesn't listen to music.
I know.
At all.
So weird.
Doesn't
so
like
weird.
Music.
Yeah.
Okay.
So weird.
So he's not even human.
Yeah.
He's a disgusting piece of shit.
Yeah.
So anyway, back to, that's why I'm trying to get young people to vote.
Yeah.
The idea of this gig that I'm trying to put together is simply to put that out there. We need you to vote. We need you to get your lazy ass out of bed, drag it down there, stand in line, have your ID, and vote. Otherwise, the motherfuckers are going to kill us all.
Yeah.
Your grandchildren won't have a livable planet to live on.
Yeah.
If you have grandchildren, which, by the way, is what I was seeing. A lot of these kids don't really plan on having grandchildren.
Right, right. You know, I was at Roosevelt Stadium in Jersey City on August 8th, 1974, when Nixon resigned. You and Graham and Stephen and Neil were playing. Graham announced the resignation from the stage. If Trump resigned, what would you want to play?
The Star Spangled Banner.
Yeah.
I'd want to play something joyous.
Yeah.
I've been singing What Are Their Names.
Yeah.
And I almost want to sing it again right then in honor of the song.
Right.
But if Trump resigned, I'd want to play something, you know, something that rocked.
Yeah.
Carry On.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Something that just rocked out.
Yeah.
Because that's how I'd feel.
And I need an audience with the king. I need to ask him. Shines like golden wind.
This is Tom Marshall with Osiris, here to tell you that Freak Flag Flying is brought to you by Pilsner Urquell Beer. In 1842, Pilsner Urquell brewed the world's first golden Pilsner in the city of Pilsen in the Czech Republic. It is still brewed in the same brewery today, using the same Czech ingredients. There are a lot of crazy beers out there these days, and sometimes I just need a lager, specifically a Pilsner. Pilsners I find to be crisper and cleaner tasting than other beer types, and Pilsner Urquell, I feel, has the formula just right. It's not fruity or bitter or overhopped. The malt and hop flavors are just balanced perfectly. They've had 178 years to perfect it. You should give it a try. Pilsner Urquell makes sure that all their beer arrives in the U.S. in less than 31 days. The product is refrigerated the entire time from the brewery in Pilsen to the distributor warehouse in the U.S. to ensure the beer tastes the same here as it does in the brewery in Pilsen. You can find Pilsner Urquell in your local grocery store, available in cans and brown bottles for freshness. To enjoy Pilsner Urquell at its best, consider pouring it into a Pilsner mug. Thank you, Pilsner Urquell.
Well, one thing that I was thinking was that when you were joining the birds and coming through the 60s, your generation definitely had a sense of its own power, like you could change the world, and you became one of the spokespeople for that generation. I am not sure that your son's generation has that same sense of itself as a potent agent of change. And that's one of the things
that may be changing because of Greta Thunberg.
Yeah, you're right. It's true.
She's an agent of change. Yep. Massive proportions. Yes. You know, she's sailing back to Europe.
That's awesome.
No print. No carbon print.
Yeah.
She's sailing all the way back to Europe.
Yeah, that's amazing. One of the things that was a huge force in your life, as much as music really, was sailing. And so you learned to sail by, was it that your parents offered to buy you half of a seashell, was it, or something like that, when you were a kid? And that was how you started sailing?
Yes.
Yeah. And how quickly did you know it was for you, that it was your thing?
As soon as I tried it, man. Yeah. That's the weird thing. Kid took me out in the boat to show me how.
Right.
And he said, here, you take this. And I said, you mean like this? And I sailed away from the dock. And he stopped talking. And he watched me for a while. And he says, okay, so who showed you? I said, showed me what? I'm sailing the boat.
Right.
He says, you're sailing the boat. I said, well, the wind's coming from there. And this, right. And it goes like, and it just, that's what it does that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Am I doing it wrong? Yeah. No, you're doing exactly right. That's weird. I already knew how.
Yeah.
So that was when one of those deja vu things.
Yeah.
When I later wrote Deja Vu. That's what I was drawn on.
Really? For all the times that you've played that song and for as much as people love it, I haven't really heard you talk about how that song came about. Like, did you actually believe in reincarnation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I still do.
Yeah.
Look, law of conservation of energy says you can't destroy it.
Yeah.
Life force is energy.
Yeah.
I don't think it gets destroyed at the moment of death. I think it goes away and comes back. I think the Buddhists have got it right. I think it's accidental, probably, but however it worked out, I think they've got a glimpse of something real. And I can believe anything I want. Fuck everybody else.
Yeah.
I can believe any goddamn thing I please. That's what I like to believe. I like to think the energy doesn't get destroyed. It comes around again as a new person.
Yeah.
And I don't think the identity print comes through.
Mm-hmm.
But there's probably ghost prints on the tape, mm-hmm. A little bit.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the deja vu experience.
Yeah.
There's like stuff that leftover kind of scraps of, ghost prints. Music's that way for me, man.
Yeah.
Got to remember, I started singing harmony when I was 6.
Right.
Excuse me?
Right.
You did what? Mm-hmm. No, it's the only thing I was any good at, man. I was not a happy camper in school. Mm-hmm. I was not a popular kid. I was a little chubby boy. And I was not one of the athletic kids.
Right.
I'm not. That was the only thing I was good at, was singing. So thank heavens there was something.
And how did you go from sailing as a seashell to owning the Mayan? Like, what was the chain of events?
I had this dream, right?
Yeah.
And they had just thrown me out of the birds.
Yeah.
And I went back down to Florida because it was good.
Yeah.
And I had friends.
Yeah.
And I went back down there and I saw her. I saw the boat and she was it. She was the one.
Yeah.
And so I did a couple of things. I cheated. I started a rumor that she had rot.
Right.
Under the mast.
Right.
Which is a place you have to extract the mast to find out.
Right.
Cost a lot of money.
Right.
And I also went and borrowed the money.
Yeah.
From Peter.
Yeah.
And
Peter Torque of the Monkees.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, he had a job.
Right. Right.
And man, I miss her so much.
Yeah. You wrote a lot of music and it saved you a lot of mind space to have the Mayan to
sing. Oh, it took me so many places, man.
Yeah.
Taught me so much, gave me so much joy.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. There's just words fail me. Yeah. Honest to God.
That's actually one regret that I have about our friendship is that I didn't get to know you soon enough to ever see you sailing.
You know, yeah, it's fucked up. You would have loved it.
I know. I would have.
It's really good, man. It's really, really delicious.
Yeah.
And the more offshore you get, the better it gets. And the more and the warmer it gets, the better it gets.
Yeah.
It gets absurdly good.
Oh, let me ask you a question. It occurs to me, it would be nice to play Vagrants of Venice here in the actual podcast. How did that song come together?
Oh, boy. I had a vision, a daydream. My head wanders around when I'm stoned. And I imagined these people 100 years from now living in what was left of Venice, Italy, when it's only just towers sticking up out of the sea. Living in the towers, fishing, sitting in the Doge's palace, fishing, homemade fishing gear, fishing for their dinner out the window. I envisioned them and they're scruffy and they're, you know, survivor types, you know. And I just started writing it. It was such a great vision, you know, that I couldn't not go there. So I wrote the words. And once I wrote all the words, I sent them to Becca and I said, "What do you think of these?" And she said, "Oh, God, sometimes I love you." And wrote that crazy music for it.
Amazing. Oh. And in a way, it's like an outgrowth of Wooden Ships, actually, because it's like a post-apocalyptic
science fiction song.
Exactly.
Yeah. I've written a number of science fiction songs, but I think those two are the two best ones, Wooden Ships and Vagrants of Venice.
Yeah. And do you know about the news today from Venice? Have you heard
I do. I've seen the picture.
Yeah. So it's like the Central Committee of Venice or whatever voted to reject the science of climate change. And this morning, the office was flooded for the first time in recorded history.
Yes.
Yeah. The
How
carbon
it is
quick.
Born vagrant fishing.
You know, as soon as I became a folk singer
and
I was on the road by myself,
these
things, you know, I was evolving a personality. Did I ever tell you the story that I used to tell about the baby thieves, child thieves?
Oh, no. Egg snatchers.
Egg snatchers.
Yes.
You genius. God, you are as smart as I tell people you are.
Yeah. No, that egg was snatchers. Paul Kantner used that in a song.
Well, it's a great story. Yeah, I used to tell this story. Yeah. I imagine myself as being an egg thief.
Yes.
And this was a story I would tell when I was singing in the coffee house.
Yeah.
I'd say
Oh, you actually wrote a song about that?
Not a song. I would tell the story.
Okay.
So the first story I used to tell.
Because Paul Kantner must have heard that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course he did.
Yeah,
I told it to him.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he, but the idea was that if you offered, you know, a young person another set of values that had to do with love and compassion and growth and change and good stuff, you would steal those young people.
Right.
I said, and that's what I'm out here doing.
Right.
I said, I'm out here stealing their children.
Right.
Ideologically.
Yes.
And when I said that, I realized you heard the words coming out of my mouth. I said, oh, that's who I am.
Right.
And it is.
Oh, that's interesting.
It always has been part of who I am. And it's one of those things that evolved, you know, but once you recognize that it's there, you're kind of okay with that.
Right.
I'm okay with that. I know it's made me piss off some people, you know, but it certainly didn't help my relationship with the birds.
Yeah, right.
You know, but it is me.
Yeah.
And it's genuine, and I'm not ashamed of it.
Right.
I understand that it's caused me problems,
right.
You know. Me saying what I said about Kennedy and stuff and me being political definitely acerbated my relationship with the birds. No question. Definitely fucked things up.
Right.
It's also who I am.
Right. Exactly.
And I'm not ashamed of it.
Yeah.
I understand that it caused me problems. I understand that it's not always the easiest path. And I understand that's not always a moral choice. It's just how I am.
You even wrote a book about it called Stand and Be Counted.
I did, but that has a lot to do with activism, too.
Mm-hmm.
There's a difference between believing things and being willing to advocate for them in public.
Yes.
Again, some shit is so clear.
Right.
Racism's so clear.
Right.
The same way when people are like that about gay people.
Yeah.
Gay people aren't different.
Yeah.
You're not.
Well, I had to figure out. I mean, the big moment for me was figuring out that the fact that I fell in love with guys was not one of the weirdest, you know, most disgusting things about me. It was actually one of the most beautiful things about me.
Yeah.
And to go with it, you know. And so because I was gay, I'm almost grateful to the fact that I had to figure out that it was okay to be gay, because it made me figure out that it was okay to be black and it was okay to be a woman. And, you know, like all that whole apparatus.
You had to go through it. You had to process the entire thing.
Exactly.
And say, okay, what matters to me here?
Right.
What's valuable here?
Right.
That's the real questions, man.
Yep.
You got, see, it gifted you in the weirdest possible way.
That's exactly true.
In a backhanded way, it was a gift to you because it made you examine it in the first place.
That's exactly true.
Well, it made me examine it too. I just wasn't confronted with it quite as closely as you were. But
you met Allen Ginsberg, the poet, and Peter Orlovsky, his lover, when they were really first going out. They used to come to the bird shows, correct?
Oh, yeah. They were the most out gay people I had ever met. They were so much fun. They would come and they would dance, and they were so silly when they danced. They were head so wide open and having so much fun. They were like children dancing. They danced like children. That's Peter Orlowski and Allen Ginsberg. They danced like children. And it made everybody love them. Everybody else is trying to do the sugar looker or the wappa-dop right. Or the hum-hum. And the dance this week is, you know, and wiggle your hip this way. Put your left foot in, you know. And these guys were just blazingly high and full of joy and obviously in love with each other and having fun.
Absolutely.
Completely, they danced like children. Man, that's a good quote.
There's even pictures of Allen dancing like that to the Grateful Dead playing Viola Lee Blues at the Human Bein in like 66 or something.
Exactly.
But he loved it. He loved it. Yep.
And that, how you saw him in that picture?
Yep.
That's how he was. That's exactly the guy that I love.
That is awesome.
And I know Allen was a complex guy, man. And there were things about it that weren't so great. You know, he's a pretty good poet.
Oh, he's a great poet.
He was
Kaddish is the height of 20th century poetry.
Yeah, but he was a difficult guy some ways too.
Yeah.
Like everybody is, right?
Yeah.
But
huge
that
ego
joy
for Wood.
That you saw in him when you played music, that was an Allen anybody could love.
Yeah.
Anybody did love.
Yeah.
Because he loved music and it transported him.
Yeah.
You know, they were fully happy.
Yeah. He was very present, actually, which you and I were talking about before is the heart of Buddhist practice is mindfulness of the present moment and mindfulness of now, basically
now.
Being there now.
Be here now.
Yeah, yeah.
It's no bullshit.
Right.
It's the key.
Right.
It's the center of the deal.
Right. Right. And your wife, Jan, actually said something interesting earlier where she referred to your songs as maps, as tools of navigation. It seems like all of you guys, Stephen back in the day, would write songs that sort of gave you advice about basically how to live and how to treat other people. Was that a very conscious decision on your part?
It's a completely unconscious thing in both of us. And Stephen's talking to himself. So was I. We're trying to figure it out. We're not pontiffs. We're not pontificating. We really are going, I think this is it. I think if I do this or I say this, this is what I think might be right. We're pretty much lost and we're looking for it, you know, anywhere we could find anything. And when every time we would find a scrap that we thought was true, we'd write it down and hand it to you. See what you thought, you know, you people out there, if a thing resonated with the best minds you could send it to, well, then you were probably into the pay dirt. You were into where you wanted to be. It really all depends on how well the thing communicates at all.
I found a map to buried treasure. I find it deep within your smile. I think that now that I have found it, I will study it.
I wear your allegiance like a cloak of trust,
wrapped around the heart of me.
No conditions were discussed when we joined forces. Falling inward, we were linked by chain across a length of rolling sea, welded by laughter and sealed in pain. That holds it anchored. It's that
trust takes years to build.
Without it, there is nothing. Just
emptiness unfulfilled.
built it up. Build a house to hold the dream. Shape that's rising from the rubble. Where the shaking death had been. I found a map to buried treasure. I find it deep within your smile. I think that now that I have found it, I will study it for a while.
When you look back over the peaks and valleys of your career, what songs do you think most purely expressed your message, you might say, the core of your message?
Wow, what a question. Okay, well, what is the core of my message? Love. Love wins. I have more than one message. Some of my message is page 43. That's probably as positive as you. Some of my message is Wooden Ships. Some is Guinevere. Some is Rusty and Blue. Some is At the Edge. At the Edge, it's one of the biggies. I don't want to pull the curtain back too far on my soul, but if you are looking for a glimpse, there's one.
Our grasp is so fragile, the thread is so thin. I wonder each day if I'm blowing away. I know that I'm lucky, I wouldn't be here at all if somebody's hand hadn't been where I stand. At the edge of a very great fall, like a lighthouse before you, at the edge of the sea, the woman whose grip when you slip, but the darkness won't get you. Your family won't go. They'll make your heart light to where you know what is right, and you go where you know you should go.
A person's art reveals them to you.
Right.
I read a book that you write. I know a lot about you, man, by how you deal with it.
Yeah.
Because your art, if it's any good,
right,
is an expression of you. And so your print is on it.
Right.
Well, in songs, even more than in books, which are very purpose-driven, songs, a lot of the purpose is self-expression, self-everything, self-fascination, self-immolation, aggrandizement, but tremendous.
Self-discovery, though.
Self-discovery.
Yes.
Very often. Wow, what did I just say?
Right, exactly.
That's my thing.
Right.
It cracks me up. I will say something in a song and realize that that's what I think. Right. But it's a secondary realization. Right. I didn't know that until I heard myself say it.
Right. The poet Gary Snyder, who was a friend of Allen Ginsberg, so I mentioned you earlier, he once said, "I don't write to say what I think. I write to find out what I'm thinking."
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, man, he's a good wordsmith.
He's a good wordsmith, yeah.
Yeah, no shit.
Yeah.
That's a really fine way to put it.
Yeah.
It's fascinating being me, man. it's a voyage of discovery.
I think I'm supposed to say okay boomer right now.
Well, you know, I didn't plan any of this. You know that, Stephen. I got no fucking idea. I didn't have a map.
Yeah.
I've been bouncing from down a what do you call it? Those pool tables, you know? The ones with the flippers, you know.
Oh, pinball.
I've been like a guy coming down a pinball sheet, you know, and just bouncing off of shit my whole life.
Right.
I didn't have a plan.
Right.
I didn't come in here extra smart.
Right.
I didn't come in here knowing what the fuck was going on.
I do think you came in extra curious. You're curious about stuff. You're a deeply curious guy.
Very. That's one of the things that made me and Jan fall for each other.
Oh, wow.
We're both insanely curious about everything. We want to know, why does it do that?
Right. And also, what makes knives sharp and what makes not work on Swedish
bottles?
Everything.
Everything.
You're fascinated by craft, actually.
I am fascinated by craft. I'm fascinated by art. I'm fascinated by life. I'm fascinated by chemistry. I'm deeply fascinated by history. History is some big mojo. You know, these are all such obvious platitudes that history repeats itself and all that shit, but it totally fucking does. If you read history, you will see the patterns. They are clear. It is not tough to see. Human beings behave in certain ways, and they evolve. And some of those ways get better, and some don't. History is a wonderful teacher, brutal, but really good. I think I've often thought, you know, do you ever have people ask you, what would you do if you didn't do what you do?
Yes, I did want to ask you that, actually. Yes. Yeah. What would you want to do?
History teacher.
Wow. Yeah. That's
There's a moment in teaching, you've probably done this, when you're explaining something to somebody and their face lights up and it's like the wire touched and there was a little spark. And this, all of a sudden, the signal goes across, and they go, "Oh, you mean that?" That's a great moment. I could live for that moment.
I believe my husband, Ward Q Normal on Twitter, who is a high school chemistry teacher, does live for that moment. He loves seeing that moment in kids' faces.
It is a joy, man. I totally get it. I could do that. I could live that life and feel, you know, that the school was a problem, that the rules were a problem, that the paperwork was a problem, that the stiffness and stuffiness and stupidness was a problem, but that the kids and seeing that light go off are fucking worth it. Just a joy. You know, I totally get it. I think it's one of the things I like best about him is he's a teacher because he loves it. As near as I can tell, he and I need to sit down and talk without you there because you take up so much goddamn air. Well, he's a wonderful guy, but he's quiet.
Yeah, he is.
You have to give him space. Yeah. You have to ask him.
He's an introvert. I am too, but he's much more introverted than I am.
Much.
Much more.
He's quiet. He's a gentle guy.
Yes.
I think that's one of the things you fell in love with.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. He's very egoless too. Which, thank God, I don't, you know, you're one of my few friends who have an enormous ego. I don't trust it anymore, actually.
Well, you know what I mean? You know, it's a funny thing. I've had to learn to deal with it, but I have found a wonderful mechanism.
Yeah.
If you have a gigantic ego, which I absolutely fucking do, make fun of the motherfucker.
Oh, yes.
That's the healthiest possible thing.
Yes.
That's why I'm all the time poking fun at myself.
Yes.
It's because that's the way I deal with my gigantic ego.
Yes.
I make fun of myself.
Yes.
You know? Oh, the sheer magnificence of me.
Oh, I know. You say that stuff all
so
the time.
Funny. You can't
it's
help it.
It's hilarious, man.
It makes you laugh.
Right.
You can't help but laugh.
Right.
But it also makes fun of that ego. And I think that's the healthiest thing I can do.
Well, I will tell you this. Last night I was complimenting you. You didn't even know. I was about to compliment you on a song called Tamil Pious High at about 3 on your first solo album, If I Can Only Remember My Name, which is a high watermark of human art to me and my friends. But in any case, so I was about to say something like that, and you say, you know, it's better to just call me an idiot. It's more comfortable. So I can see how you actually have learned. You've bruised people that you love with your ego over the years. Actually.
Yeah, and I don't want to.
Right.
And I also, the bigger your ego is, the more you feed it, the less growing you can do.
Right.
The more you suppress the ego thing, the, oh, I am terrific, right, the more open you are to new shit, the more you can learn and grow.
Right.
I would like, sincerely like, to be growing the day before they bury me.
Right.
I'd like to learn some new shit on my last day.
Right.
And have been doing it the day before, too. That's a moral and philosophical point that I'm not really willing to compromise on.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
I want that. And I don't think having your ego be entrenched and nurtured and defended and the main authority leaves room to grow. It doesn't. It doesn't make you the kind of human being that I imagine I want to be. It doesn't feed compassion, which I think is the surpassing wonderful aim. You know, it doesn't feed growth. Are there things in your life you're willing to lay down your life for?
Explain it to him. What am I gonna say when it's something that grim? How the hell do you tell the comes and in? How you gonna handle it and still be their friend? How do you explain this world we face? All of the innocence we brought to this place. These and other questions stand in a row, and I'm not satisfied with the answers I know. What are you going to say to those I can't even get close to those lies?
Freak Flag Flying is proud to be sponsored by Vermont Pure CBD. Vermont Pure CBD grows their own organic hemp, processes their own oil, and makes their own products, all in Shoreham, Vermont. They use sustainable and natural methods to grow and transform hemp into healthy products, including the highest quality full-spectrum CBD products. They have tinctures and topicals, skin creams and balms, and edibles like CBD dark chocolate and even CBD capsules. Vermont Pure CBD is committed to only using the most natural, unprocessed, sustainable, and local products. They happily choose to pay more for ingredients that meet these criteria to keep the overall quality high and to support responsible producers. Vermont Pure CBD treats every plant, every product, and every customer with the care and respect they deserve. Try it out today. Go to VermontPureCBD.com and enter the code OSIRIS on the shopping cart page to get 15% off your order. Vermont Pure CBD. Enjoy your wellness.
I wanted to say that probably something that only someone who knows you really well would observe, that you have, you know, you have this famously huge ego. Everybody talks about how you're a Leo and you have this, you know.
Yeah, well, Leo, you know, it's the truth. Whatever.
But I wanted to suggest the opposite as well, which is that I feel like you've been very humble before the muse, Like, you have followed the muse in many different directions. Like, you are grateful for whatever she's, you know, giving at the moment. Like, you really listen hard to something that is not easy to hear. You know, you follow stray winds of improvisation, like, in beautiful directions towards melodies that are uncannily beautiful. You know, and I feel like
I did something better than that.
What's that?
I made it be more important than anything else.
Yes.
And that saved me over and over again, kept me aimed at the higher end of the spectrum over and over again.
Yeah.
I'd be wallowing in being a fucking junkie.
Yeah.
And the music and the desire to follow it and the desire to learn from it and have it grow and have it be more magical even than it was yesterday.
Yeah.
Would pull me out of the mire and up into the, you know, the creative space again. I just wish I had never wasted all that time.
Yeah.
God, it bugs me. You know, when they say that to you, when they interview you and they say, do you have any regrets? Oh, Christ, you got an hour?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. My biggest regret, even more than the people I hurt, and I hurt people, is the time I wasted. I could have been writing goddamn symphonies.
Mm-hmm.
I could have made three times as much music as I've made.
Mm-hmm.
If I hadn't wasted years of time just getting smashed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How smashed can we get? Well, I don't know, Dave. Let's try.
Yeah.
Oh, good. I drooled on myself and nodded out.
Let me ask you a question, man. God knows this has been talked about way too much, I think, but when you were getting high that way, did you enjoy it? Like, was it hellish?
Not really.
Was it good? You know, like,
not really, man. Yeah. Once you're addicted, then you're just feeding the monster.
Right.
You're just trying to keep from coming down.
Yeah.
That's it. Your life turns into that. It cancels higher consciousness pretty much.
Right.
And your behavior gets really grubby.
Right.
And you're willing to do whatever. It's mostly just so you can stay canceled out.
Right.
Those drugs are painkillers.
Right.
Cocaine is too.
Right.
They used it as a painkiller, as a local anesthetic,
right,
because it also shrinks the capillaries.
Mm.
So it would cut down on bleeding. For eye surgery, they would use it.
Mm.
But that's technology. That's not what I'm talking about.
Mm.
The reason people become junkies is to shut out the pain.
Mm-hmm.
They do not want to be here.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be somewhere else where it doesn't hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I'm totally familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. It's just you're killing yourself while you do it.
Well, you were introduced to painkillers at a time when you were at your most pain of living, really, after the death of Christine in a car accident. Is that not correct? I mean, you might have been introduced to it before that, but...
Yeah, I just didn't have any way to deal with it.
Yeah.
I didn't have any equipment. Nobody teaches you about death, your own or anybody else's. Nobody tries to make sense out of it for you. All the ways that they tell you that they're telling you about it are fairy tales that are utter, complete bullshit.
Right.
Religion is nonsense, utter nonsense. And there you're loving somebody and you think you're starting to fall in love with them. And it's like a brand new experience and you've never actually really done that. And it's getting kind of magical. And she takes the cat to the vet and never comes home. And I just wasn't equipped. I didn't have anything. Like being a little swimmer, big wave. I took some junk.
Well, plus you had just been through the weird experience also of being the bee's knees and having like the biggest hit record. You know, you won that Grammy for the first CSN album. And so you were like enduring this rapid rise to superstardom and then this most horrible thing that ever happened to you ever and ended her life happened to you. Must have been so much to process.
Yeah. The success stuff is all just disorienting. You know, people want you to treat it like a surreal world, and it's not. It's just bullshit.
Yeah.
A bunch of bullshit. But But this was real.
Yeah.
And it was more than I could handle. Simply enough. And so, yeah, I totally don't recommend it.
Yeah.
That, you know, you deal with shit however you have to deal with shit. And that's how I dealt with it. I think if I could have avoided that, I could have made a whole shitload more music.
Yeah.
To return to my original beef, which was that I wasted the time.
Right.
Whatever the cause was, the time got wasted, and that's a really shameful thing.
Right. It's so profound. It's a real fans of your music that the last song that you wrote before your muse really got so pissed off she split for a while was Delta. And then one of the first songs, I know you wrote a couple of others in prison, but one of the first songs that you wrote in prison was Compass. And they bookend an experience of being lost in a really profound way.
Don't they?
Yes.
Lyrically.
Yes,
particularly.
Exactly.
Yeah,
they do.
Yeah, I had noticed that, actually. Somebody else pointed it out to me. And yes, you're absolutely right. And those were the two songs. They were
right.
It's funny that, you know, I tried to describe it to people, man, that there were plottable curves.
Right.
The increase of drug use and the decrease of writing.
Right.
We're almost matching curves in opposite directions.
Yeah.
The more drugs I did, the less I wrote. Until
right.
I stopped writing, didn't write anything, and Delta was the last thing I wrote. And then I woke up in prison, remembered who I was, and wrote...
Compass, yeah.
Compass.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is not bad.
Oh, no, it's good, actually. And dare I say, it's not the best CSNY record of all time, but... On the CSNY record, harmonica part is really, and it's bone chilling.
Good, isn't it?
As it should be.
Yeah, at that point we were calling the Jimi Hendrix of the harmonica.
That's hilarious.
He is like really, he's such a puzzling guy, man. He's a wonderful musician.
Yeah.
He has innately in him the ability to create wonderful music.
Ask you a question, and this is a tough one. As a guy with a big ego, you went through one of the most spectacular public denigrations and humiliations of anyone in pop culture, basically.
I did.
You did. You went from being, you know, the spokesperson for a generation to my favorite David Crosby joke of all time is from The Simpsons when you were playing yourself and Homer meets you and says, David Crosby, you're my hero. And you say, I'm glad you like my music, man. And he says, you're a musician? So that was, you know, that got to that.
Funny
the picture
line.
Of you in People magazine is sitting in a jail cell. How was that for you? Like, it must have hurt like.
It's awful, but it's not the significant part.
Okay.
The significant part is the part we've been saying.
Yeah.
The significant part is it nearly destroyed the art.
Right.
The significant part is it definitely almost killed me.
Right.
Those are the really salient facts. That's the stuff we can learn from this.
Right.
Wallowing in how awful it got.
Right.
Doesn't help.
Right.
It was awful, and I remember all of it, and I don't want to go through it again for
right.
anybody.
Right.
But I picked out what's significant to learn from it, and that I want people to know very badly.
Right, right. Can we also talk about, Jan went through all that with you and stayed loyal to you.
Yes.
You guys have a love that has been tested and endured through the biggest shit storms life can throw at you.
Possibly. Life and death, yeah.
Right, right.
Nothing less.
What is it about your relationship that has made it last for so long?
I know this is going to sound corny, okay? Mm-hmm. We actually fell in love with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we are both flawed human beings.
Mm-hmm.
She's nowhere near as crazy as I am, mm-hmm. you know, but we are both flawed human beings. And, mm-hmm. But we have learned to love the whole person. I mm-hmm. love the whole girl. Mm-hmm. Mistakes and all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she loves me. Mm-hmm. All the mistakes and all. Because I've been honest with her and we've seen each other over the years down to the toenails. We know exactly who the other person is and we love them anyway.
Yeah.
Deeply.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we've seen the heart.
Yeah.
She has a good heart, man.
Yeah.
That is a treasure. You don't find it hardly at all. As yeah. you know, because you found one.
Yeah, I know.
It's a rare thing yeah. to have somebody, when you see it, you fall for it. You fell for him.
Yeah.
You know you did. You love the guy, man. Yeah. I feel that way about her. I fell for her because of that heart, that spontaneous, warm, generous, loving human being. That is there when she's happy. When she's not happy, yeah. it's a whole other ball of wax and you don't want to be there. But when she's happy, you fall in love with her. That's what happened.
Yeah.
I did.
Yeah.
And I really am glad I did. And it has yeah. been a rough and rocky road. And yeah. I'm stunned that she stuck with me.
Yeah.
Because I put her through hell.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I treasure her.
Yeah.
Because of how she has dealt with it.
Right.
You know, she's a good human being, man. She was, oh man, is she a good mom.
Yeah.
Django had the most joyful childhood of any kid in the world.
Oh, that's awesome. Because
her sense of play is so strong.
Yeah.
She's like Blue is, you know, when he gets down in his forepaws and he goes, looking at
yeah,
you
yeah.
cocked over one side, yeah. you think, you want to play?
Yep.
Well, that's Jan.
Yeah.
She's that.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
man, Django yeah. was so, he was so happy.
Yeah.
It was unending, joyous, whoopee, all the his whole childhood. It was really great. She's very talented at that.
Yeah.
She's a really good mom now, too. She's a really good family center.
Yeah.
She loves our family, and she treasures it and makes it be worthy.
Yeah. Not an easy job being her, either.
No.
Because you cast a big penumbra.
There's that, too. And also, yeah. there's people have actually, you know, other times in our life when we were together, people tried to bust us up.
Right.
You know, they thought, well, that they could get me away from her. That would somehow help me get me away from the drugs. And mm-hmm. what I was giving them to her, not the other way around.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she's a joy, man. She's
yeah.
a joy, and I'm a lucky fucker. That's yeah. really basically the deal.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you're being generous enough to let me sleep in the guest cottage on your place. And I carry incense with me because I'm a Buddhist and I meditate every day. So I have this little travel, you know, crappy incense burner I bought in a head shop somewhere. I noticed that yesterday, without saying anything, she put a beautiful cup filled with rice, which is the traditional, you know, way that millions of Zen students all over the world burn their incense. She just put it in between my crappy little travel incense burner and this Buddha in the room that I'm sleeping in.
That's her.
She didn't say anything.
No.
She just knew that tomorrow, when I lit the incense to meditate, I would find this convenient, beautiful Japanese cup right there.
She does stuff like that all the time. She calls yeah. it leaving crumbs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's
great. Trail of crumbs.
These are the things, these are the things we do. These are the things, these are the things we do.
At first it's just fun, but love is long. A little each day, you build it that way.
being round. Another set of hands. It's not what you want. It's only that you will kindle the flame.
See you all for the next episode of Freak Flag Flying, where I'll talk with David about the power of harmony, the singers that have inspired his approach, from the Everly Brothers to an obscure recording by the Bulgarian folk choir that broadened his musical horizons, and his masterpiece solo recording, If I Could Only Remember My Name, which assembled one of the most gifted group of musicians ever to perform in the same studio, including Joni Mitchell and members of the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane. Freak Flag Flying is executive produced by Adam Kaplan and Tom Marshall. Interview, narration, and editing by me, Steve Silberman. Mixed and mastered at Telescope Audio. Promotions by Christina Collins and RJB. And thank you all for listening.
In a whisper, in a shout, say it how you want it.
This is the story of Whitney Houston.
This is the story of Kurt Cobain.
Of George Michael, of Otis Redding, of Amy Winehouse, of Michael Hutchence, Bob Marley. This is the story of Prince.
It's a new podcast series.
About how they died, why they died, and why we're still talking about them so long after.
It's like nothing you've ever heard before.
It's storytelling.
But it's more than that, because rock stars,
they tell us how we feel. They change our mood.
They change the clothes we wear, the people we hang out with,
the way we remember things.
It's them who give us those ludicrous moments, the ones where you're
jumping around, singing your heart out, feeling understood.
And it's those moments we'll help you remember, the ones you're thinking about right now.
That feeling.
That feeling.
It's coming soon from Crowd Network.
Just search for Death of a Rockstar on your podcast app.
And subscribe now.